This is the Diehards.
Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Tom Brady takes the snap, drops to the knee, and the Patriots have won their sixth Super Bowl title.
The Diehards start now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Welcome into the Diehards. I am John Lyons, alongside the one and only Mason Souza. Mason, welcome in tonight.
Oh, you're too kind, John, the one and only John Lyons. It is a pleasure to do Sports Map Radio, whatever the case may be, with you. We are earning our money tonight. We are approaching. We are basically there, the dog days of summer, but some big news happening.
Yeah, we have a pretty full show tonight. I mean, we're going to talk about the Kevin Durant trade or lack thereof and why that price has not been met yet. Donovan Mitchell, reports are today the Jazz are listening for offers. We are going to talk some football later, and of course the MLB All-Star rosters are fully out. We're going to talk about them, but we're also going to spend some time on NHL free agency, which, if you don't know, began at noontime Eastern today. There's been a lot of player movement, a lot of trades. And the headline, or really within the last hour, is that now former Calgary Flame Johnny Gaudreau is signing a 7-year deal with the Columbus Blue Jackets. Now, Gaudreau, for those that don't know, one of the best offensive players in the NHL, and he's the first guy in, I believe, 12 years that scored 40 goals in a season and then switched teams the following offseason. So this is a 40-goal scorer, high-impact guy. Columbus is really looking to take that next step to true contenders, and I mean, Gaudreau, arguably the best name on the market, the best offensive player on the market, has a new home.
Yeah, massive money right here, looking at 9.8. Not official just yet, but it seems like it's around that number for 7 years. That's huge for Columbus. I mean, it's funny because, you know, I'm looking at Calgary. Obviously, he's been there his entire career. BC kid, 115 points, second only to Connor McDavid last year. And that's a crazy stat, 40 goals and the only one to switch teams. That's pretty shocking. So this is a serious move. I'm just curious, obviously, going to a lesser team, talking about, you know, Columbus compared to Calgary, who won their division. I'm just curious what that correlates to them being a...
Yeah, I mean, it'll be a shot in their arm for them offensively, I think, no matter what. But we're going to get into that more. But next, we're going to tell you why Kevin Durant has not been traded yet and why Donovan Mitchell should be. Stick with us here on the Diehards.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Back here on the Diehards, I'm John Lyons alongside Mason Souza, and we kicked off the show talking some NHL free agency, which did open today. But one of the things that's been on my mind, really not just today, but over the last several days, is we've been going through one of the biggest trade requests, in NBA history with Kevin Durant, because it's not only a player of his caliber, but it's 4 years left on the contract. So this is arguably one of the biggest trade requests in NBA history, and it's been a little over a week now. No one's met it, and as far as I can tell, reports are, yeah, half the NBA is called. There haven't been a ton of in-depth, serious discussions. And I think a lot of that has to do with Durant's age, and the Nets' asking price. So reports are the Nets want two All-Stars and picks. Now, we talked before, Mason, last week about all the potential All-Stars that the Nets can't get because of that designated rookie extension rule because they have Ben Simmons on their roster. So for me, if I'm the Nets, first of all, I'm looking to unload Simmons to try to make this more available. But I'm starting to wonder, is Durant going to be on the Nets opening night? Like, I don't know if anyone's going to meet this price.
Yeah, it's very curious what exactly the holdup is 10 days later, because we all remember the big, you know, when he went to Golden State in the first place, the 4th of July weekend, everyone and their mother was out to court him, you know, over in the Hamptons. And, yeah, it almost seems like, yeah, like you said, I'm sure half the league or more than half the league, I would think, has inquired, at least done their due diligence. But no one's really, like, shaking the fence at midnight, like, come to my team. So to your 2 points there, I don't think it's the first one, Durant age. I don't think that scares a lot of people. But then at the same time, you know, on the other side of my mouth, I look at Durant and the Nets getting swept by the Boston Celtics. How did Durant get swept? They bodied him. They made him uncomfortable, put a guy on him, physical, get on the Slim Reaper, make him work. And he kind of shut down a little bit. He got his points, but it almost kind of seemed like empty points in the end. But the second point, the Nets. Yes, the asking price with Kyrie, that situation going on, Kyrie opting in like, okay, I guess no one else wants me. And the Nets didn't really seem like they wanted to be done with him. And now Durant on the other side. Okay, Kyrie's back. Get me out. Like, what a dumpster fire. I think Brooklyn's trying so hard. Listen, like, we emptied our assets into you guys. We're going to make this work. The Nets are trying so hard. Like, please. Like, we're going to make this work. So, I don't know. At this point, moment in time, I believe both Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving will be playing for the Brooklyn Nets to start next season.
Yeah, and I think, look, the Kyrie situation is weird because nobody really wants him because of all his other baggage. But Durant, I feel like there's a lot of teams that want him. And to your point about the playoffs, the last time we saw him was game four of the first round. And he had 39 points in that game. He played awesome.
Yeah.
But the first three games of that series was as frustrated he has ever been in his career offensively. He was not shooting the ball well. He didn't look comfortable handling the ball. Even in game one, Kyrie had 39. Durant was quiet. And if you think about that series, Boston swept the Nets, but they won that series. Each game, the average margin of victory was 4.5 points. That's the third closest in a sweep ever. So my point is, Durant was so frustrated, he wasn't even getting that 4 or 6 more points that would have won the Nets a couple games here. You know, and I still don't think the Nets would have won that series, obviously. But my point is, the Celtics had him so frustrated in the first three games, by the time he broke out in game four, it was too late. And maybe teams look at that a little bit. I also wonder, not as much the age, but the health situation. In the last 2 years combined, he's played 90 total games in 2 years. He had that Achilles injury in the NBA Finals in 2019. He had an MCL sprain this past season. I wonder if teams say, oh, not so much that he's 34, but now he's had two significant injuries, one requiring surgery. Is he at the point now, after being in the NBA since 2007, is he going to start to break down, have more and more injuries? And remember, the last year of that contract, $54 million. What if he's broken down by
38 years old or whatever the case may be, yeah.
But I guess, and that to me skews it a little. Like, if I'm the 76ers, I trade for Durant right now because I look at Joel Embiid as 2 or 3 years from now as a big man. He might break down, so my window's short. But if I'm another team that has maybe a little bit longer of a window, like Phoenix, I know that's one of his preferred destinations. Dallas, they have young stars. In Dallas's case, a young superstar. You might not want to shoot. Now, look, do you want Durant? Yes. But do you want to mortgage everything for a shorter window if Durant might? That, I wonder if that's giving teams pause.
It seems like everyone looks at the Golden State Warriors, and we'll get into Donovan Mitchell and the Utah Jazz in a minute here, but it's like the Golden State Warriors have done it right. Like, you know, they drafted correctly. Obviously, they got a world talent, Steph Curry, out of nowhere in the middle of the first round. And they have, we talked about this before, they seem like they have the next dynasty lined up in the next 4 or 5 years.
Yeah, the second wave core,
the second wave, there you go. So, yes, to the point of when it comes to, like, I think of, you know, our team, the Boston Celtics back in 2008 when they traded for Kevin Garnett, got Ray Allen. It was only a couple window thing. And then obviously Danny Ainge made that massive trade, you know, and it was kind of start over. But do you mortgage yourself for a championship? I say yes. If you're a lowly team that's been, you know, if you're not on a team that has LeBron or you're not the Golden State Warriors, yes, you go for it. You do what the Toronto, Raptors did.
With Kawhi Leonard. And by the way, they won. So it worked.
So it
and I think they would take that. And
yeah.
The only thing that I think is the problem with the Nets, like, if I'm the Nets, I want 2 All-Stars and picks. The problem is, how many teams have 2 All-Stars to give you? Without it, I think it's going to end up being a 3-team deal.
Yeah.
And maybe Ben Simmons is involved in that risk. Because if I'm the Nets, maybe I want Donovan Mitchell and another All-Star, but I can't get them without getting rid of Ben Simmons. I got to maneuver around. But really, how many teams straight up, like Dallas, they can't give you 2 All-Stars. Phoenix can't give you two All-Stars. Miami can't give you two All-Stars.
And this is based on this designation rule.
Part of that, but part of it is a lot of these teams don't have two. I mean, think about it. To have two All-Stars on your team is kind of rare.
You got Tatum and
Brown. And I would say Philadelphia,
right.
They have Embiid, and they have Maxey, and they have Harden. So that's three All-Star-level players, but you're not going to give up Embiid because the point of getting Durant is to play with Embiid.
Correct.
Harden's not going to go back
go
to the Nets.
To
so, yeah, you have Maxey, but still then you're kind of short. So, like Golden State and Boston – I don't know if either team would do it because they were just in the finals and they have young cores in it with Golden State's case, an old and a young core. I wonder if the Nets are just going to have trouble just on the logistics. Like, not a lot of teams have two All-Stars to trade. So they're going to have to find a third. Wouldn't shock me if it's a four-team deal. And there's all kinds of crap going on around the bend. And one of those names I just mentioned, who, if I'm the Nets, I want 100%. If I'm the Boston Celtics, I want 100%. If I'm any team, that's Donovan Mitchell. And what's interesting about the Jazz, they hire Danny Ainge as their alternate governor, executive VP, whatever title you want to give him. But if you look at Danny Ainge, he has built two different versions of the Celtics that went to the finals in different ways. So he had a bunch of prospects that with one star in 2007, and he kept the one star and used the prospects and picks to get Ray Allen and Garnett. They won a championship. Now, I know some of Brad Stevens' moves this year, specifically getting Derek White, getting Al Horford back, probably put the Celtics over the top in the East. But that core, he traded away Pierce, Garnett, and then he got Tatum and Brown. He picked Smart. He drafted a core. So he's done it two different ways.
Yeah.
And I wonder if he went to Utah and said, look, Rudy Gobert is a great defensive player. Donovan Mitchell's an elite scorer. You're not going to win a championship with those two. Let's do it the way I did it with Tatum and Brown. Get a lot of picks. A lot of young guys. And I wonder, does Mitchell, and he's got 4 years left on his deal too, by the way, does he want to have the patience to wait 2 years before they're a finals contender? Or does it behoove him, A, to go to a contender, and B, the Jazz, to get a haul that they would get for him?
So it's very interesting how you brought up Ainge and, like, his, you know, I would think, you know, Utah Jazz brought him in for this, this reason. Justin Zanuck over there is the GM with Ainge at his side. I think it's more so the first part. I think it's, quote-unquote, mortgage, get the superstar rather than building with young talent. Because you look at the Golden State Warriors, like, yeah, that seems like that's the only – you got the Phoenix Suns, obviously, that were number one. Dallas as well in the West there to compete with. But at the same time, it's curious why Donovan Mitchell would be on the, quote-unquote, you know, trading block – if they're trying to, they're getting, they got five players and five picks for Rudy Gobert. Somehow, some way. I don't know how that's possible. You know, if this
pretty
is,
impressive haul.
Really pretty impressive. Danny Ainge, let's say, won that deal. I don't know if he was at the trigger on there, but Danny Ainge won another deal. Is Durant in play for you? Can I pull my Brian Windhorst for a second? What is going on in Utah?
Think it's a great question because you look at, like, if the Boston Celtics had Tatum, Brown, and Donovan Mitchell, they probably win a championship.
Oh, hell yeah.
If the Miami Heat had Donovan Mitchell and Jimmy Butler, if the 76ers had Joel Embiid, and like, to me, he is that, because he's a star. Look, he's made the All-Star team three straight years. I don't know if I put him in that superstar, first-team, all-NBA level category. To me, he is an ideal second star, much like a Kyrie Irving was to LeBron in Cleveland. I think if you, like, let's just say Utah found a way to get Durant with Mitchell. Like, or some point is, if you're a team that already has a first-team, all-NBA type player, maybe not on the first-team, all-NBA this year, but that level of player, I want to get Mitchell because I think Mitchell is an ideal because he can score. He can facilitate. Now, he's not going to defend, you know, that great. But he's a guy that you have an alpha dog number one. To me, he's an idea. But the problem is, too, he's been the alpha dog in Utah. Does he accept that little change in his role?
Yeah, I'm not entirely sure. It seems like with 26 points, 5.3 assists, you know, he brings down some boards as well. Yeah, I agree with you to the point. He's just below that superstar level. But, yes, of course, every team would lung a young point guard slash shooting guard in Donovan Mitchell. So, yeah, it's why they would want to do that. And to your first point of just get a boatload, an absolute shipload of all these picks, and then just turning it into something over the next 5, 6, 7 years.
Stick with us here on the Diehards because the NBA is not even the biggest story of the day. We have NHL free agency, which we're going to dive into coming up next.
You're listening to the Diehards on the SportsMap Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Welcome back in to the Diehards. I'm John Lyons alongside Mason Souza. And look, we started the show talking a little bit of NHL free agency. The big news, Johnny Gaudreau switching teams from the Flames to the Columbus Blue Jackets. The first time in 12 years a player has scored 40 goals and then switched teams that following offseason. And Mason, the last thing you brought up right before we went to break that segment was, well, how much better does this make the Blue Jackets? Now, obviously, we know it makes the Blue Jackets better.
Yes.
But the Blue Jackets are a team in the Metropolitan Division. They were close to the bottom. They had only 81 points last year, 37, 38, and 7. Really just a below, the best way to describe it is below average. They weren't awful, but they were not good. Yeah. And this is a team that 2019, they beat the Lightning in the first round. They take the Bruins to six games. The Bruins eventually went on to the Stanley Cup final. And they've really had a downward trajectory since. I wonder, though, you had a 40-goal scorer. Obviously, that's going to help. But is it enough to get them from 81? And look, this division, the Hurricanes had 116 points this year. The Rangers had 110 and were in the conference final. The Penguins, I know that core is aging, but we know how good they are. They had 103 points. The Capitals had 100 points. They had four teams in this division with 100 points, which is
unreal.
First of all, it's crazy. But you got Carolina's going to be good again. The Rangers are going to be good again. And even if the Penguins and Capitals fall back a little, I mean, they were still 20 points better than the Blue Jackets. So I wonder, does Gaudreau make up 20, for lack of a better phrasing, does he make up 20 points?
Yeah, it's going to be I mean, I am looking at, you know, you have him on the left, Gaudreau, and then Patrick Laine on the right. That's a solid 1-2 right there to get some points, some goals, I should say. 14th, right smack in the middle of the league. Can you get to top 10 with that? Possibly. I think so. That team needs a lot of help elsewhere as well. It's only Gaudreau can only do so much. But at the same time, yeah, look at that. Those rivals that they go up against, that's a lot of firepower, a lot of teams that they need to fight with. It's going to be, you know, a tough climb. You know, obviously with 7 years, they don't expect to go to the Stanley Cup in their first year with Gaudreau, but with 7 years, you know, maybe they're building toward, we were talking about Utah, what are they building? Columbus. And, you know, free agency just start. We'll see what Columbus is building.
And their problem was really not offensively last year. They scored 262 goals, which was kind of in the middle of the pack in their division. They were one of two teams in their division to give up 300 goals last year. The Devils gave up 307. The Blue Jackets gave up 300 even. So, look, Gaudreau's a great scorer. I still think, and again, he's going to make them better. I still think the biggest issue for them is they gave up 300 goals last year, and they got to find a solution to that. Another move that really caught my eye is the Boston Bruins traded Eric Halla, who for most of last season, especially the second half, was their second-line center, and in my opinion, I thought he played really well in that role. They trade him to the Devils for Pavel Zacha, who was the sixth overall pick, I believe, in the 2015 draft. He's a highly talented guy who hasn't quite figured it out yet. Who knows if he will, but he's a restricted free agent, assuming the Bruins traded for him to negotiate. Well, what I find interesting about this move, Brian Windhorst, why did the Bruins do that? To me, this signals they have a some sort of understanding slash agreement with Patrice Bergeron and David Krejci. Because I look at Zacha, he can play center, but if he's your third-line center and they either move Charlie Coyle or they put Charlie Coyle on the wing, or he's a third-line wing and you have Bergeron and Krejci as your two centers, I mean, picture this top nine. Your first line would be Bergeron, Marchand, and DeBrusque, who, by the way, DeBrusque, when he was with Bergeron last year, played really well. Second line, Krejci, Taylor Hall, David Pastrnak.
Solid.
Third line, Coyle, Zacha, and Craig Smith. To me, that's a top nine that can rival most of the teams in the NHL. And I'm not saying the Bruins are going to win a cup because I know they have other issues. But as a top nine, that's really good.
That's a lot of pretty decent to high-end talent in the top nine. I totally agree with you. Yeah, and to your point, I thought the same exact thing when it comes to Patrice Bergeron and David Krejci.
if they were to trade for a top six guy, I think on the flip side, they'd be like, uh-oh, what does that mean? One of these guys is done. Is Bergeron done? Krejci's staying over in the Czech Republic or whatever the case may be, that league. I remember it was like a Czech coach saying, like, what are you doing here? Talking about David Krejci, like, go back to you're way too good to be here in this league. So it seems like that's gotten
it does
his
seem
head
like,
to compete some
more. And look, I criticize the Bruins for firing Bruce Cassidy, and I think the Bruins' problems have a hell of a lot more to do with bad drafting and development than they do with Bruce Cassidy.
Look at the 2015 draft.
Right. But Cassidy gets fired, and all of a sudden it looks like Krejci and Bergeron to come back, and DeBrusk rescinds his trade request. Do think there's a little smoke there. That being said, I still think the guy got scapegoated because if the Bruins had drafted better and they had won a cup in 2019 or at any point in the last 4 years, those guys wouldn't mind if Bruce was a little mad at him sometimes.
I find that very interesting because, you know, Bruce Cassidy seems like, you know, a no BS guy, tell it like it is. Kind of like, you know, not to switch sports here, but kind of like Ime Udoka is with the Celtics. Like, guys, stop playing like a-holes here. It seems like that's what Cassidy's doing, the same thing with his Bruins team. And then, yeah, if, to your very point, if Bergeron and Krejci come back, oh, everything's good, DeBrusk is happy, whatever.
Especially
the case
Krejci. Like, I think Krejci, you look at it, the Bruins for 15 years had the best 1-2 center combination in the NHL. I mean, Bergeron's winning Selkies, it feels like, every year. He's a good offensive player. Krejci is a great passer, really good goal scorer as well. He led the Bruins in goals scored in their 2011 Cup run. So Bergeron, I mean, he played with Cassidy, kept with him, and it seemed like he might come back anyway. But Krejci, to go all the way to the Czech Republic, leave a situation where you've won a Stanley Cup, you've been to three, including one with this head coach, and all of a sudden the head coach leaves and you're back in Boston. Looks
like, very peculiar.
To me, I can't speak to the Bergeron issue, but it feels like Krejci definitely had a beef with Cassidy, did not want to play for him, and now he's back. And look, here's the thing. I mentioned that top nine, again, as good as a lot of teams in the NHL, it still doesn't solve their problem 2 years from now when those two guys are gone. They have nobody in the pipeline that's going to be a starting center in the top six.
Right.
Like, that's an issue they have had for 15 years. No good young centers. They still have it now. And in the NHL entry draft last week, they drafted three centers, so they know it's a problem.
Right.
I just wonder, I mean, and the other thing, Bergeron and Krejci are both turning 37 this year. Now, look, Bergeron just won another Selke, and I still think they are good. But I don't think the Bruins can rely on them to be 2013 Bergeron and Krejci or even 2019 Bergeron. There's going to be some diminishing skills there.
Yeah.
Which Taylor Hall is going to have to step up.
Absolutely.
You know, he's shown some flashes, but has he looked like a true number one overall pick the whole time he's been in Boston? I don't think so.
I think that's what they're hoping with this Zaka trade. You know, Taylor Hall, obviously former number one overall pick 11 years ago, had kind of a revitalization with the Bruins. Had one of his best years perhaps in his career.
Maybe that second half after they traded for him, he was awesome.
Absolutely.
Yeah, outside of his one MVP year, which was in New Jersey, that might have been the best stretch of NHL hockey he played.
I remember being excited, like, oh, my God, we have finally, like, a number one overall pick on the Bruins. Like, he made it. It was a new scenery. It's like, situation with, what's his name, Sagan going to Dallas. Like,
right.
It's the situation with a change of scenery. Maybe it's the same thing Don Sweeney's thinking, like, oh, I can do the same thing. Grab a top 10 pick that has, let's be honest, like, has not performed like a top 10 pick for his first 6 years or 7 years of his career. Bring him over here with strong leaders. If Bergeron and Krejci's coming back, a prolific scorer like Pastrnak, you know, strong defense with McAvoy and all these guys, let's see if he can be that talent that he was drafted to be. And, you know, I think Sweeney's maybe feeling himself a little bit. Like, I did it with Hall. He seems to be in his somewhat his form here. I'd like to do the same with Zaka. And then, you know, if Bergeron calls it a career, Zaka feels like he can contribute. Maybe we move him up a line.
Yeah, and I think, let's just say Krejci comes back. There's a lot of pressure on him the first 2 months of the season because you're going to have Bergeron potentially miss the start of the season. Marchand's going to be out the first couple months. Charlie McAvoy is going to be out the first couple months. If Krejci comes back, I look at him and Jeremy Swayman as probably the Bruins with the most amount of pressure on them.
Because a lot of stuff on their shoulders.
They need to stay above water till all these guys comes back because this top nine I'm talking about might not be together until January. And, hey, if they have more rest, if you will, that'll be better for the postseason. But the Bruins have to, A, hope Krejci comes back, and then keep themselves above water the first couple months of the season. We'll be right back on the Diehards. Alex Barth joins us to talk some NFL football.
This is the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Welcome back into the Diehards. I'm John Lyons alongside Mason Souza. And joining us on the Progressive Guest Line is 98.5 The Sports Hub's Alex Barth. Alex, how are you doing tonight?
Good. How are we doing, guys?
Doing well, doing well. And for those that don't know, Alex covers the NFL, specifically the Patriots for 98.5 The Sports Hub, but he also dabbles in some NBA, kind of the pinch hit artist of whatever 98.5 needs. And Alex, I want to start off with the NFL, with football. And there's a lot of second-year quarterbacks. So Mac Jones, Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, Trevor Lawrence. You can throw Trey Lance into that. He had a couple starts last year. Of that group, which ones or one are you expecting to take the biggest second-year, maybe Joe Burrow-like jump this season?
Individually, I think Trevor Lawrence, I think he's an incredibly talented player that was massively held back by a horrible situation last year in Jacksonville with Urban Meyer. Team-wise, I think it's Trevor Lawrence. Individually, I think it's Mac Jones. I think he's put in the work this offseason to be better. I wonder if the situation, you know, he could be better. The overall offense could look not as good. I wonder if that's the case with the Patriots, with the insecure coaching staff. But I think he's going to look much better. But I think the biggest jump statistically, if you want to talk fantasy, all that, is Trevor Lawrence. It has to be. He's too good. He's too good to struggle the way he did last year.
And what are your thoughts on Trey Lance? Because Trey Lance had two starts last year. He looked much better in the second one. And when he was drafted, you know, the fit seemed great for that Kyle Shanahan offense. But he's still going to be, you know, in his first year starting the entire season. Do you think he can come out of the gates and play really well? Because to me, the 49ers have a lot of pieces of a Super Bowl caliber team, but obviously Trey Lance will be in his first time as the full-time starter.
So here's the thing. When we evaluate quarterbacks leading up to the draft, right, there's a tendency, and I'm guilty of this as much as anybody else, oh, well, this guy's going to be really good. Oh, this guy's not going to be good. This guy I like. This guy I don't like, right? When the reality is we only have half the equation. The player himself is only half the equation. The other half is the landing spot. It's nature versus nurture, right? Trey Lance, I liked him as a prospect. The San Francisco 49ers and Kyle Shanahan have done everything they possibly could to ruin this kid. The uncertainty, the in and out of the lineup, and, you know, Jimmy Garoppolo now being back. I just think it's a lot on his plate mentally, and I wonder what that's doing for his development. I think he has a ton of raw talent. I really do, but he probably hasn't had a ton of chances to work with the ones. I can't imagine, with Jimmy Garoppolo being the starting quarterback last year, there's this pressure of he has to overperform, right? The other guys we're talking about here, Mac, Zach Wilson, Justin Fields, Trevor Lawrence, you could even go down to Davis Mills, they're the starters. They can go out and operate like a starting quarterback. Even other guys, like you want to go deeper in that draft, Kellen Mond, Kyle Trask, well, I'm not necessarily expecting anything from those guys. Knowing you're the backup, and obviously everybody's competing to be the starter, but knowing you're the backup, there's some certainty there. It's less of a load mentally. I really wonder what's going on right now with Trey Lance behind the scenes. I think the 49ers have put way too much on his plate, the way they've structured this whole thing. And I wonder what that means for his development.
Alex Barth here joining us, 98.5 The Sports Hub, at Real Alex Barth on Twitter, talking some football here. I'd like to move on to the Pats real quick, if we can, Alex. You mentioned it in your first answer, talking about Mac Jones taking a leap possibly in his second year. You also indirectly kind of mentioned the uphill battle he might have to climb with the, you know, uncertainty situation on the coaching staff. And I know we've talked about it ad nauseum since the offseason has started here in New England, but I want you to try to get into Bill Belichick's mind, if you will. Like, what exactly is his game plan with setting up the coaching roster as is? Obviously, he has his two kids on the roster with ideal roles. You know, Brian Belichick is even there as a cornerbacks coach, I want to say, or a safeties coach, I want to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Steve Belichick, is he calling the plays? Is he not? Is Gerard Mayo coming in? Obviously, Matt Patricia, Joe Judge, all the like here. Is he just trying to, I'm talking about Bill now, leave behind like a legacy, if you will? Is he actually trying to set up this future at the Patriots for the long-term future? Because currently speaking, you know, obviously we look at Patricia, we look at Judge, quite frankly, failures at their last stops as head coaching gigs. It just seems like everyone under Bill Belichick, you excluding Gerard Mayo, seems like they don't really know what's going on here.
Well, I'd say this. I have mixed views of what the coaching staff is. People say, well, everybody working for Belichick is a failed former head coach. Well, if you didn't fail as a head coach, you're not going to be an assistant. You're still going to be a head coach, right?
Good point.
So, you know, could he go out and try and hire younger people who maybe just haven't gotten to that path yet and try to develop them? Certainly. And I think there is value in having a mix of guys who have been there and done that and guys who are on the rise. I think they have some of those guys who get less attention. You mentioned Gerard Mayo, who every year, I can't believe he's back, should have been a head coach 2 or 3 years ago. They have a couple guys on the offensive side of the ball. Troy Brown's a name a lot of people know just because he played in the league for a long time. He won Super Bowls. The tight end coach, Nick Cayley, is somebody I like as well. In terms of, you know, is he trying to leave a legacy? I think that's part of it. How could it not be, right? He wants to make sure his kids are in a good position, that they can have long careers in the NFL. But I think a lot of it is he wants people around him he trusts. And some people will construe that as he wants yes men. I wouldn't go that far with it, but I think he has a young quarterback in front of him, a guy he needs to develop. And, you know, a name that got thrown out around a lot this offseason was Adam Gase. Would he trust Adam Gase? Like, does Adam Gase have more experience working with quarterbacks than Joe Judge? Yes. Would he trust Adam Gase more than Joe Judge in that situation? I don't think so. I certainly wouldn't. Adam Gase struggled last year as a high school offensive coordinator. I wouldn't give him the keys to an NFL offense, certainly not. So I think he wanted guys he could trust. He wanted guys he know he's familiar with, guys who are familiar with him. And Judge and Patricia happened to be available. Well, Patricia last year, right, and then Joe Judge gets let go. I think he wanted Bill O'Brien. I wonder if Bill O'Brien was hesitant to leave Alabama just because if he's going to get a head coaching job staying at Alabama another year. That team is loaded. He has a Heisman-winning quarterback. They should be a national championship favorite. If they do that, odds are he's going to start getting head coaching calls. So Bill O'Brien's the one guy that doesn't fit into this formula, but I wonder if he was truly available. After that, I just think Bill, specifically on offense, I think Bill wanted people he trusts, he's familiar with, and are familiar with him.
And if Mac Jones is going to take a leap into his second year, like John mentioned at the start, a Joe Burrow likely, although unlikely, but I think the defense is going to need to help him in a serious way. More specifically, the pass rush. You know, Matthew Judon had an incredible start his first year with the Pats. Who do you see on the opposite side of Judon kind of stepping up to kind of provide a consistent pass rush along with Judon when in regards to the Patriots?
So based on the roster right now, and I know this is a cop-out, I think it's a rotation. I think you have three guys over there in Josh Uchane, Anfernee Jennings, and Ronnie Perkins who all can kind of play that role. And I think they all have upside, but I think they all play it differently. And I don't know that one's better than the other, but they all do different things, right? And the Patriots like to be a matchup team and have all these different looks. I think you could see those three guys kind of rotate on a game-to-game basis, on a drive-to-drive basis, depending on what the situation calls for. I would think that's the plan right now, and I don't hate it. You drafted all three of those guys high. You got to play them eventually. They've been buried the last couple of years. You got Kyle Van Noy and Jamie Collins, right? Well, those guys aren't in the building anymore. The other thing I'd say is if Dante Hightower comes back and his situation is still uncertain, he's a free agent. I don't think he's a middle linebacker anymore. I think he showed that last year, but anybody who watched the Patriots when they won those second three Super Bowls knows that he can be just as effective off the edge, arguably better off the edge. I wonder if they bring him back as a situational edge guy, and Trey Flowers is another name that's been floated as a guy who could come back, who I think could fit in on the edge too. So pending those two signings, I think you see a rotation of the younger players. If one of those guys comes back, I would think that guy features heavily in that role. And it's an important role. It really is. I know, we talked about the defensive line there, but that strong side defensive end is not a pass rusher in their system. That's a guy who's just setting the edge. it's really the outside linebacker on that side that's doing that. And Kyle Van Noy was so good last year. I think had the best season of his career last year. That's not an insignificant, it's not insignificant production to replace. So it is a key question. I just think the way they're built right now and the way they've done things historically, I think there's odds that it's a platoon. They go with a platoon to try to replace them.
Alex, I want to go back to your earlier point about being surprised every year that Gerard Mayo is not a head coach in the NFL. And I agree with you. I think he's a great coach and will be a very good head coach in the NFL. And I'm wondering if there's going to be a shift in Bill Belichick's focus, because Josh McDaniels for years essentially had the keys to the offense. And that doesn't mean that Bill Belichick didn't have oversight, didn't have input, but it was Josh McDaniels calling the plays, game planning, and Belichick would spend more and more time with the defense. I wonder now, with more uncertainty, newer coaches on offense, if he's going to shift and spend more time there and give Gerard Mayo and Steve Belichick, but especially Gerard Mayo, more freedom on defense, similar to what he used to do with McDaniels. Do you think that's a possibility, or do you think just Belichick being a traditional defense-first type coach, he's going to still focus more on that?
I don't think he views himself as a defensive first coach. I think he views himself as a football coach. He's talked about this, and it's something he imparts on his assistants, and they've talked about it, right? Matt Patricia was a defensive coordinator. He started off coaching offense. Josh McDaniels' first title job with the Patriots was as a defensive assistant. He makes sure that everybody can do everything. That being said, based on what we saw in the spring and spring practices, it was what you suggested. Bill was spending more time with the offense than defense, significantly more time. He wasn't totally away from the defense, but he spent a lot of time with the offense, specifically with the quarterback, the skill and skill position players. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes. I would think when it comes to game planning and breaking down the film and coming up with ways to stop their opponent, Bill Belichick is arguably as good as that on the defensive side of the ball as anybody in the history of the game. I would imagine he'll still be involved in that. When it comes to the actual coaching of the players, I could see him kind of giving some of that to Gerard Mayo and Steve Belichick and him focusing more on the offensive side of the ball. But the other thing is, he's always focused on the offensive side of the ball. As long as Tom Brady was here, they had those Tuesday meetings, right, where they'd meet every Tuesday and go over film, and that continued with Cam Newton, and it continued last year with Mac Jones. It's more about the game plan element of it. But like I just said, I still think he will be involved game plan-wise defensively. I just think when it comes to the actual teaching part, I think he'll spend more time with the offense, which is a younger group, so it kind of makes sense. It's the group that needs more attention.
And I want to move on from the Patriots to staying in their division, the Buffalo Bills. So the Bills, they're 13 seconds away from beating the Chiefs last year, and in my opinion, they were also 13 seconds away from going to the Super Bowl, because I think they would have beat the Cincinnati Bengals the next week. But you look at the Bills, they have that tough loss coming back this year. They're still obviously the top dog in the AFC East, but with that loaded AFC West, do you look at them, and the Ravens, of course, getting healthier in the AFC North, do you look at them as the favorites to go to the Super Bowl in the AFC, or do you think it's still Kansas City or the Chargers or Cincinnati or a team like that standing in their way?
Yeah, I don't think it's the Bills. I don't. This is the last year truly of their window to be elite. Josh Allen's extension is going to kick in next year. Stephon Diggs is going to turn 30 next year. Look what happens to wide receiver production numbers when guys turn 30. You got some guys getting older on the defensive side of the football, some contracts up on the defensive side of the football. This is it. They've got to do it now. This is as close to the favorite as they're going to get. That being said, I look at the Buffalo Bills as a very inconsistent team, and I know people are going to kind of see that and recoil. What are you talking about? They were so good last year. They were 11-6, and Josh Allen had a three-month stretch. If you go from the start of October to the last week of regular season in the playoff game, the first playoff game, right, against the Patriots, he did not post a quarterback rating over 90 in back-to-back games. He did it every other week, but he didn't do it back-to-back games. And I just don't believe that's sustainable. Can he get more consistent? Yes, he certainly can, but I need to see it to believe it. He can have a bad game at the wrong time, and the Bills avoided that last year. And I think, too, the Bills were sort of this new thing. The teams didn't know how to defend. Everybody's basically playing prevent against the Bills. We saw in that Kansas City game. People talk about that as the greatest, one of the greatest offensive games of all time. Or even look at the Patriots game, right? Oh, the Bills didn't punt. It's the greatest offensive game ever. Or is it the worst defensive game ever? You look at the cushion of that. He's fought and opened guys left and right. Let's give credit. Instead of giving the credit to Josh Allen, let's give credit to Gabriel Davis, who I thought had a masterful performance in that game. Gave Josh Allen, you know, a car's length on each side to throw the football. I just wonder, like, Josh Allen has those rough games. They almost caught him at times last year, and they didn't. I just don't think he's going to have that horseshoe up his ass 2 years in a row. I think it's going to catch up to them this year, maybe in a minor way, maybe in a major way. I think you have the Chiefs, who are a really good team. I think you have the Bengals, who are a really good team. I think you have the Raiders, the Broncos. The Chargers are good. I have my concerns about them as well. I think you have the Ravens, too, if Lamar Jackson is healthy, which is a big if, but that's on the table as well. I think there's too many good teams this year in the AFC versus last year where the AFC was putrid. There's too many good teams in the AFC this year for the Bills to be as inconsistent as they were last year. So that's the thing to me. Consistency, I will worry about consistency more than just about any other trait. I think it's massively underrated across all sports when it comes to teams, when it comes to players. How consistent are you?
Thank
Until
you very
the Bills
much.
Be more consistent, that's it. And I know you've got to run me out.
Yeah, no, thank you very much for joining us, Alex Barth. He is Real Alex Barth on Twitter, covers the NFL and sometimes the NBA for 98.5 The Sports Hub. Thank you, Alex, and stick with us here on the Diehards. We will be right back.
You're listening to the Diehards on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Anthony Pepe and John Lyons.
Back at it here, wrapping up hour number one. I'm John Lyons alongside Mason Souza, and it's been a pretty interesting sports day because we did have the start of NHL free agency, which we talked a little bit about, and we had Alex Barth on. Thank you, Alex. Interesting to me that he's not that high on the Buffalo Bills. I wouldn't say he's down on the Bills. He's not that high on it.
I'd say he's down on the Buffalo Bills, absolutely. No, but he brought up some interesting point. Like, while everyone's saying, like, Josh Allen's the next big thing, he brought up some very good points of how wildly inconsistent he might be.
Stick with us here on the Diehards. Hour number two coming up next.